She needed a new identity, a new face, new prints, everything that came with that. And then, Sam wondered, what do I do with my life? She kept thinking of Mai, of her sister Anna, of the young Sam that she'd been.
I want to protect them, Sam thought to herself. Above all, I want to keep them safe.
She turned and faced south. Out there, somewhere near a village called Meidong, there were more children like Mai.
Samantha?
It was Vipata, the young nun who'd been assigned to Sam.
It's time for meditation.
Sam turned, suddenly aware of what she looked like with her nearly bald head and her white robes. A Buddhist nun. It brought a smile to her lips. She brought her hands together in a Y to Vipata.
Thank you, Vipata,
she answered in Thai.
Please lead the way.
She headed into the hall to meditate with the nuns, to feel their minds in the practice called Vipassana, the observation of self in the meditation called Metta, the state of loving kindness, of compassion towards the self and others. They would meditate and they would become one. She couldn't remember ever having experienced anything so beautiful in her life. The touch of another's mind in that deep, serene state, the touch Nexus enabled. How could it be wrong? How could she have fought so hard to stop it?
Who am I becoming?
At 22:49 hours, under a dark, cloudy night sky, 30 kilometers off the coast of Thailand, a portion of the radar and sonar absorbent upper shell of the Boca Raton began to open. Fissures appeared on the rounded foredeck of the submersible covert operations ship. The fissures defined previously invisible panels. The panels became depressions as the ship drew them in. They slid slowly, silently to the side, opening to reveal a combat deck below. As the stealth hull retracted, rounded launchers on the combat deck canted up, tilting from their horizontal resting positions up to an angle 30 degrees above the horizon, pointed north towards the Thai mainland. For a moment, all was still. The dark ship bobbed silently in the tropical swells of the Gulf of Thailand. Then the first launcher fired. A dark, elongated shape streaked out and into the night sky. 780 milliseconds later, the second launcher fired. Then another, then another. In under 10 seconds, the Boca Raton put 12 Viper-class UAVs into the air. The recon combat drones opened their stealth, downturned wings 1 second into flight, activated their own jet engines, eased into level subsonic flight 10 meters above the waves, and scattered. As each Viper streaked into the night, its attendant launcher began to tilt back towards horizontal. Within seconds of the last launch, the radar and sonar absorbent panels of the stealth hull began to slowly slide back into place, obscuring the combat hull. Secrecy must be maintained. In the air above the waters of the Gulf of Thailand, the AI in control of Viper 6 got its bearings and compared them to the plan. The drone banked its wings, turned to head north by northeast, angling around Bangkok's crowded airspace and traffic control radar, and towards Saraburi and the mountains to the northeast. It had payloads to deliver. Excerpt from transcript. Face America with David Ames, Saturday, 4/21/2040. Host.
And welcome back, everyone, to Face America. We're here this morning with National Security Advisor Dr. Carolyn Price. Dr. Price, thank you again for being here.
It's a pleasure, David.
Dr. Price, let's move on to the situation in Thailand. A fire and multiple shootings in Bangkok yesterday reportedly left more than 30 people dead in a location connected to distribution of the street drug Nexus. The Thai government alleges that U.S. forces were involved. What can you tell us about this?
David, our hearts go out to the families who lost loved ones in that fire. Of course, the U.S. was in no way involved in this. Thailand is a close ally and an important partner in regional issues, and we hope that as emotions cool, the Thai authorities will realize that they're mistaken.
What do you make of these reports of heavy gunfire in the area?
Well, as you say, David, this building was apparently being used to distribute illicit drugs. We've seen drug-related violence in Mexico, in Afghanistan, in Colombia. Quite possibly this was a turf war between rival syndicates. These well-armed crime syndicates are part of the reason that President Stockton has made cracking down on the drug trade one of his top foreign policy priorities.
The Thai authorities are saying the DNA evidence has identified an American at the scene, a man named Michael Lee, who they assert was an undercover American agent.
Well, David, while Mr. Lee lived in the U.S. for a number of years, he's actually a child of Chinese immigrants to Thailand. So, to use his presence to allege that the U.S. was involved, when the same evidence provides a tighter link to China just to the north, is a bit odd. I hope the Thai authorities are asking Beijing some hard questions.
So this man was not a U.S. operative?
Absolutely not.
And there were no U.S. operatives there?
None whatsoever.
I'm going to play a clip here from a press conference this morning in Bangkok where Thai authorities showed off evidence found at the scene of the fire, which they say conclusively links the U.S. military to the event. Roll film.
Man speaking in Thai. Camera pans across table. Objects on table appear to be firearms and knives, warped and melted by extreme heat. Man continues speaking in Thai. Subtitle: American-made covert operations weapons. More than 20 items recovered. Only obvious explanation.
What do you make of that?
David, I think that film speaks for itself. Those guns are so warped and melted, it's difficult to even tell what models they are. And unfortunately, it's far too easy to acquire weapons of all sorts from any country on the black market today. That's why President Stockton has made combating the international arms trade, especially of the newest, most high-tech weapons, one of his highest priorities.
Let's move on to the situation in Turkmenistan.
End transcript.
Viper 6 banked after its sixth drop, circling to the left to come around north by northwest towards the mountains northeast of Bangkok. It flew low, barely 5 meters over the rice paddies and sugarcane plantations, under the radar. Its AI steered it clear of villages and farmhouses. It flew past Rop Myung, past Nakhon Nayo, past Phram Mani, paralleled Highway 33 at a safe distance until it saw the village of Ban Na, then curved around north and east, hugged the terrain as it went from flat to rugged, followed a ravine carved into the stone millennia ago, up towards greater heights. At 1,200 meters, it popped out of the ravine, acquired its target with its onboard optics, calibrated against its internal GPS. This was Target 7, its AI confirmed. Viper 6 opened Weapons Bay 2, flew low and slow over the monastery, and launched a spray of tiny 8-limbed surveillance robots out and into the night air. One by one, they drifted down and onto the target. 43. Just breathe. Cade woke to the sound of dawn bells. Sunday morning. Just over a day since everything had gone wrong, since Watts had died, since Narong had died, since Ilya and Rangan and so many others had been arrested. The meditation had soothed him last night, for a while. Then had come sleep, and with it, dreams. Dreams of rage and destruction, of breaking Warren Becker in half, of burning Martin Holtzman alive at the stake, of tearing black-masked agents limb from limb as they charged into that apartment. They'd been cold dreams. The death he'd meted out had been cool, methodical, satisfying. He was cold inside, cold and full of rage. That was all he could feel. There was a knock at his door.
Come in,
he replied.
Bon entered. The young monk had brought him a bowl of porridge for breakfast. He placed the bowl on the table, then made a Y to Cade with his hands, smiled, said something in Thai which might have been a joke or a happy comment.
There was so much joy in this place. What did it feel like? Was there joy for him, on the other side of this rage? On the other side of this numbness, was there anything? Perhaps destroying the ERD would give him joy. The thought brought a small smile to his lips. The doctor came to see him shortly thereafter, changed his dressings, checked his wounds, injected new growth factors to knit bone to bone, heal skin, restore damaged lung tissue. The eye was still gone. It was still so much less than he should have lost. He should have been the one to die, not Watts, not anyone else. His hand clenched around the fob hanging on a chain around his neck, beneath his orange robes. Its hard edges bit into his palm painfully.
You should have lived, Watts. This wasn't worth it.
He rose, crutched himself towards the meditation hall again. He'd learned much last night. The monks had learned to integrate Nexus 3 into their minds. They hadn't reprogrammed the Nexus cores, or scanned the radio spectrum and mapped Nexus's responses, or reverse-engineered its underlying instruction set. No, they'd meditated. They'd sculpted their own minds to the Nexus, found ways of thinking and being that gave them deeper control over it, and in so doing, they'd learn to achieve a synchrony that he'd never experienced. They'd learn to let thoughts flow smoothly across the boundaries that separated individual minds. They'd learn to merge into something larger and more sentient than they were individually. It impressed him deeply. He had much to learn here. He reached the meditation hall early, situated himself in the back, closed his eyes, focused on his breath. Monks filed in. He felt them, heard them. They sat as they entered, cross-legged, spines erect. They breathed. Cade felt his own breathing synchronize with theirs. The connection between their minds firmed. The greater mind began to coalesce. Cade could feel them all. He was aware of the tiny ripples of thought that passed through their minds. Every tiny thought, every word, every snippet of song, every momentary fancy, every thought of chores, every question of teachings, every itch, every urge to move. The room felt them all. Together their collective consciousness observed itself. As each thought or sensation arose, it was perceived, acknowledged, released. Attention returned to the communal breathing. It was hypnotic, serene, crystal clear and coherent. The room sparkled with their shared attention, with an almost physical sense of the collective mind they comprised. Their minds were so quiet. Cade's was so loud in comparison. The same thoughts kept returning. Watts, Ilya, Rangan, Narong, Charya, Niran, Lalana, Mai. The dead and the missing, the uncertainty of the future, the guilty who'd done this. There was no grief. The software in his mind kept that at bay. His emotions were as hard and sharp and brittle as ice. Only anger, only rage, cold rage, impotent rage. Every time the thoughts arose, the collective mind observed them, acknowledged them, released them, returned its awareness to the rhythmic breathing of their bodies. And every time they returned. They meditated together until lunch. Cade ate in the mess hall in silence, lost in himself. The monks finished their meals, headed off to their afternoon chores. Cade crutched painfully back to the meditation hall. There, seated at the far end of the hall, facing Cade, the giant golden Buddha statue behind him, was Professor Somdet Pra Ananda. The old monk's eyes opened at Cade's arrival.
"Child," he said in his deep, sonorous voice, "come and sit with me."
Cade crutched himself across the room, reached the pillow Ananda indicated, slowly lowered himself, ribs aching. He could feel Ananda's mind, buoyant, radiant with calm and clarity, fluid, flexible, relaxed. His own mind felt icy, numb, frozen in a single thought.
"How are you, child?"
Ananda asked.
"I'm healing," Cade said.
"I'm angry," he thought.
"Thank you for letting us come here. This must be a risk for you. We were out of options." "Enough people died that night,"
Ananda replied. Cade nodded. The memory of it was cold. There was nothing where grief or sorrow should be. Anger, hatred, that was all.
"I felt you meditating,"
Ananda said.
"It's amazing what your monks have learned to do," Cade replied. "I'm hoping to learn more of it." "To what end?"
Ananda asked. "To kill them," Cade thought. "To hurt them. To break the ERD. He stared at Ananda blankly for a moment, struggled to control himself.
"I don't know."
Ananda studied him.
"Your thoughts are cold, child. They're rigid. You shield yourself from what's within you, even as you shield yourself during meditation."
Cade looked down. "I don't feel anything. Nothing feels real."
"You've shackled your own mind. Release it."
The serenity package. Cade nodded.
"Yes, it calms me." "It numbs you,"
Ananda replied.
"It freezes you. That is not the same thing."
Cade kept his eyes on the floor.
"Release the shackles on your mind, child. Then you'll experience what's going on around you."
"I think it's all that's holding me together," Cade said.
"Then perhaps you should fall apart,"
Ananda replied. Cade felt the monk's mind touch his own. Could he do it? Could he turn off the serenity package? Horrible things lurked beneath the surface of his thoughts. He might burst from them.
He feared his own emotions. "There's no way forward for you without letting yourself melt,"
Ananda said. "Or burn," Cade said softly.
"Yes, or burn."
"People died because of me," he said. "They'd existed. They'd had thoughts, emotions, plans, gone, all gone."
"Yes, that is your karma,"
Ananda replied. "I want to hurt the ERD. I want it so bad." He could feel the bloodlust, feel the anger, feel the rage, the only thing that got through the Serenity Package anymore. "But it was also my fault," he said. "If I'd made different choices, those people would still be alive." Ananda nodded.
"Perhaps it was your fault."
Cade trembled.
"My fault? Those shackles, they're there because I don't know if I can face it. If I can face really feeling what happened."
"The past is gone, child. Those men and women are gone, dead or imprisoned. You cannot change what has already happened."
Cade nodded. Ananda continued.
"But you can choose what you make of it. You have a choice to make. Will you make their deaths mean something? And if so, what?"
Cade nodded again. His fists were clenched. "That's what I've been thinking about. Rage or emptiness, nothing else."
"But you will make no headway until you allow yourself to feel. Until you can face your pain, you will not go past it. I will be here with you. We will face it together."
Cade took a deep breath, shook his head.
"I can't."
"You can,"
Ananda replied.
"It's too much. I can't."
"If not now, when?"
The old monk gestured around himself.
"If not here, then where?"
Cade pulled up the control panel for the Serenity Package in his mind. It would be so easy, just a flick of a switch. He shook his head.
"I can't."
"Then your friend died for absolutely nothing."
The words were like a slap to the face. Cade went red, his fists clenched. He flicked off the Serenity Package with a thought. The grief surged up around him, came over him like a wave. It bowled him over. It found the cracks in him and suffused every corner of his mind. It filled him up until there was room for nothing else, until he would burst with it, with the pain, with the sorrow, with the heartache, with the despair of all that he'd lost, all the death that he'd brought about.
"Watts. Watts."
The faces of the dead and lost to him rose up in his mind.
"Ilya, I'll never see you again, Ilya."
The loss of all that had been good in his life threatened to destroy him. It threatened to wash him away in a flood and leave just a husk where he had once been.
"Rangan, I'm so sorry, man. I miss you."
The pain of knowing that he had doomed innocence permeated him.
"Narong, Lalana, Charya, Niran, my..."
He felt Watson Cole die again, felt the man's mind burrow into Sam's.
"Protect him,"
he felt Watts's last urging to him.
"Set it free. Give it to the rest of the world. Give them what it gave me."
He heard Watts's last words before the explosion.
"You got shit to do, brother. Go do it."
He saw Narong go down with a burst of bullets in his belly, felt the boy's fear and confusion, the way he died because of Cade, because Cade had given those bastards a tool to coerce him with. He felt Lalana wink out of existence in a hail of bullets. He felt Areva burn to death, felt Losan die in pain, felt old Niran cut down as he tried to save Lalana, felt Charya mourn her dead family. He felt magical little Mai fade away with Sam crouched above her.
"Will you make their deaths mean something?"
Ananda had asked him.
"Yes,"
Cade answered.
"Yes."
He felt the gentlest of mental touches from Ananda, a feather brush of mind against mind. Ananda was breath. He was awareness. He was untroubled, undiluted awareness.
"Breathe. Breathe. Watch the breath go out. Watch the breath come in."
It was sweet. It was solace. It was emptiness and silence. Watts faded slowly from his mind. breath expanded in his ears, his sight, his sense of his body grew and grew to fill his mind.
Breathe. Breathe. Let go. Breathe. Watch the breath go out. Watch the breath come in. In. Out. Breathe. Observe.
Ananda was tranquility. Ananda was peace. Ananda was awareness. His mind was Cade's lamppost when the darkness and confusion of guilt and remorse and despair came over him.
Observe the thoughts. Let them pass. Bring your attention back to the breath. Breathe. Breathe. Breathe.
Spider BR-674 crawled silently along the roof of the hall, its skin the same color as the ceiling it clung to. It had been exploring for almost 12 hours now. It had identified 43 unique individuals. Its sisters had identified another 227 in total. 78% male, 22% female. So far, there had been no sign of any of its primary or secondary targets. Spider BR-674 had observed a large number of individuals emerging from a doorway in this building, all together, earlier in the day. It had accordingly increased the priority of a search of this building and broadcasted that fact to its sisters. Three of them now crawled through it. There was another door ahead of BR-674. IR showed two human forms within, seated. BR-674 considered the door for a moment, telescoped a foreleg to explore the gap between door and doorway. It would do. BR-674 clung close to the ceiling, flattening its shape, and crept between the door and the doorway it was set in, into a large open room. Two human-shaped objects, alive in IR, sat on the floor at one end of the room. The one facing it was a person of interest. It logged that fact. The other faced away from BR-674. It began the long trek across the room. It took 9 minutes for BR-674 to cross the room in full stealth mode. The two warm human-shaped objects remained roughly stationary in that time. The person of interest's eyes were closed. Its chest rose and fell, consistent with respiration. BR-674 consulted its decision tree and provisionally labeled the person of interest as alive, consistent with body temperature and respiration, and asleep, consistent with a long duration of eye closure and silence. It left a flag indicating possible reevaluation due to seated position. Finally, BR-674 reached a position where it could see the facial area of the second human-shaped object. This human-shaped object also respirated, also with eyes closed. More interesting was the face. Facial recognition routines identified a possible match with one of its primary targets, but a number of the details were different in unexpected ways. Spider BR-674 hunkered down, double-checked that it was functionally invisible, and broadcast a burst of data to its masters.
Breathe. Breathe.
Cade had lost track of the hours he'd spent here. Ananda was tireless, the rhythm of his mind as flawless and eternal as ocean surf against a beach. Cade, on the other hand, he was tired, more at peace, but so tired. His concentration was fraying, random thoughts sneaking back in around the absorbing tranquility of his breath. And then he felt it. All around him, behind him, throughout this room, scores of minds unmasked themselves, sitting calm and silent in rows and columns. How long had they been here? And then, as one, the monks began to breathe, in time to Cade and Ananda. The effect was electrifying. Cade felt himself buoyed by it. He was not just one. He was many. He was all. The minds in the room were a web, a tapestry, an orchestra of thought without thought. The room breathed in. The room breathed out. A thought occurred in the mind of a novice. It rippled across the mind of the room. All observed it. All brought attention back to the breath. It lifted Cade up. It filled him with a peace and clarity he'd never felt. He felt utterly clear, sober, grounded, balanced. All fatigue left him. Shadows vanished from the corners of his mind. As one, they brought their collective attention to their symphony of breath. Let go of the anchor of attachment to the past, to what had been, to what might have been. There was only here. There was only now. There was only breath. There was only mind. 44. Findings. Aboard the Boca Raton, an icon on a screen turned yellow, began to flash for attention. Jane Kim tapped the icon, expanded the alert. One of the spiders at Target 67, a possible match. There, that face. Caden Lane in monk's robes, shaven head, a bandage across his face. And across from him, Professor Somdet Pra Ananda, personal friend of the King of Thailand. Kim paged Nichols in his stateroom. He would want to see this. While she waited, she turned her attention to the other spiders at Target 67. If Lane was there, Catarones might be there too. She updated the target profile for Catarones to include the possibility of a shaven head, bandages, and monk's robes, and redirected all of them towards finding primary target Beta, Fine Blackbird. 2.5 hours later, they did. She was still alive. Becker answered the phone at 4:13 a.m. Sunday morning, D.C. time. Sunday afternoon in Thailand, the Boca Raton. They'd found Lane and Catarones, monastery, undefended, within range of retrieval. The data was spooling to his slate now. "Get the ball rolling," he told Nichols.
"Do we have clearance to launch?"
"You will in 4 hours." White House, National Security Advisor's Office.
"This operation was a complete clusterfuck, was it not?"
Senator Barbara Engels asked.
"And now you want to follow it up with an armed invasion? This is crazy."
Becker wanted to rub his temples. The senator's voice made his head hurt. The meeting had stretched on for more than an hour already, going round and round on the same topics.
"Thank you, Barbara,"
National Security Advisor Carolyn Price said.
"We appreciate the input of the Oversight Committee."
The senator shook her head.
"You're looking at a lot more than input here. If this blows up in our faces, you're going to see hearings in my committee. Hearings during an election year. Does that register with you? You people are off the deep end."
Secretary of State Abrams nodded his head in support.
"I agree with Senator Engels. We can't further provoke the tie."
"They're harboring a criminal,"
said Becker's superior, ERD Director Joe Duran.
"A possible post-human being who's coerced and abducted our agents, used them to kill our men. We have to go in."
Duran's boss, Homeland Security Secretary Langston Hughes, nodded his approval. Price turned to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Stanley McWilliams had been largely silent throughout the meeting, studying the details of the plan that Becker had sent him on his slate.
"Admiral McWilliams, what's your view on this?"
The silver-haired admiral looked up from his slate, met Price's eyes, held them steadily.
"This mission is a crock of shit."
Becker felt himself bristle. People around the table straightened themselves in surprise. Becker opened his mouth to reply. Price held her raised palm out towards him, her eyes still on McWilliams. The reply died on Becker's lips.
"Go on, admiral."
"First, we shouldn't have launched those recon drones last night. We have a chain of command for a reason."
His eyes flickered over Becker and then Maximilian Barnes.
"I've made an enemy," Becker realized. Going around him and his people pissed him off.
"Second, this mission looks good on a slate, but no plan survives contact with the enemy. Everything has to go perfectly for us to get in and out without being detected. That's possible, but unlikely. If anything goes sideways at all, we'll be caught invading an undefended civilian holy site in a nominally allied country. And for what?"
He slid his slate across the table, a picture of Caden Lane on it.
"For bullshit. It's not worth it."
Everyone started talking at once. Price held her hand up.
"Quiet!"
The noise stopped as quickly as it had begun. She gestured to Becker.
"This is your plan, Deputy Director. What do you say to the Admiral's objections?"
Becker took a breath, tried to project calm.
"Admiral McWilliams is correct that this could go sideways. My commitment to you, Admiral, is that at the first hint that there's any chance of discovery of the mission, we'll abort it. What I weigh against the risks are the national security value of understanding the methods the Chinese have for coercion, the importance of keeping fourth-gen enhancements and Nexus 5 off the streets, and my personal passion for getting a loyal agent home in one piece. I'd think you'd understand that."
I'd be touched if you showed half as much passion for the civil rights of ordinary Americans.
McWilliams drawled back. Becker flushed. That prick. People started talking at once, stumbling all over each other. CIA Director Alan Keyes threw up a hand in exasperation. Senator Engels chuckled in amusement. Maximilian Barnes just leaned back and watched it all, impassive.
Quiet!
Price slammed her hand on the table this time. Silence returned at once.
Admiral McWilliams, she said, remember where you are and keep your personal opinions contained.
She slowly scanned the room, as if daring anyone to make a sound. No one did.
The President has made the elimination of transhuman and posthuman threats one of his top national security policies,
Price said.
We serve to implement those policies. At the same time, we do not want to be seen as taking unauthorized military action inside Thailand. Given that, I'm going to recommend to the President that we move forward with this operation under very specific conditions.
She lifted an elegantly manicured hand, locked eyes with Becker, counted off her conditions on dark-skinned fingers.
First, no action against Su Yong-shu unless you can provide concrete evidence of direct action by her against American forces and in violation of Copenhagen. Everything you have here is circumstantial. Get proof, and you'll have your clearance to go after her.
Becker nodded.
Second, only stealthed equipment and only then under the cover of night. Third, no civilian casualties, not a single one. You load non-lethal rounds and you only switch to lethal if there are no civilians anywhere in the area and you're returning lethal fire from your missing agents or another combatant. Fourth, absolutely zero, and I mean zero evidence of U.S. involvement. This will not become an international incident, and this will not become an issue in the U.S. this November. If there is even the slightest chance of detection, you abort immediately.
Becker nodded again. He didn't trust himself to speak. Price scanned the room, looking each of them in the eye. ERD Enforcement Division Deputy Director Becker, Secretary of Homeland Security Hughes, ERD Director Duran, Director of the Central Intelligence Agency Keyes, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs McWilliams, Secretary of State Abrams, Senate Oversight Committee Chairwoman Engels, Special Policy Advisor Maximilian Barnes.
Are we all clear on this?
McWilliams snorted. Barnes watched the room silently. Everyone else nodded, voiced their assent.
Good,
Price said.
I briefed the President in less than an hour. Admiral McWilliams, you're welcome to accompany me and present the case against this mission. I'll let all of you know the President's decision immediately thereafter. Good day, gentlemen. Good day, Senator.
45. Anyone. The symphony of mind finally ended. The thoughts of the greater mind went from thick braids to wispy tendrils and then to vapor, dissipating in a glorious sigh of contentment. Everyone opened their eyes, made respectful wise toward the altar. Ananda gestured for Cade to remain as the others filed quietly out.
How do you feel now?
Ananda asked him. Cade considered himself, observed himself.
Better. Calmer. Tired.
Ananda nodded.
Good. This was just a beginning, but a good one. You will heal.
Thank you, Cade said.
Ananda nodded again.
Su Yong-shu will arrive to visit you tonight. It will be after midnight.
Shu was coming. He had so many questions for her. Was the anger what drove her on? Could she heal? Could she release her hatred?
I'll see to it that you awaken when she arrives,
Ananda said. Cade nodded his thanks.
And tomorrow you move on.
Cade nodded again. Safety meant moving, for now. He would miss this place. There was so much he wanted to know.
The things you're doing here,
he asked.
The things you talked about at the conference. Where are you going with all this?
Ananda smiled.
You've seen some of what goes on here. You've heard me speak. What does it seem like we're doing?
You're teaching monks to use Nexus, to integrate it permanently.
Yes.
You're showing them how to meditate together, how to synchronize their minds further.
We're learning that together.
You talked about group minds, Cade said, about taking neuroscience from the individual to the group level.
Yes.
You're trying to make it real here.
Ananda held Cade's gaze with his own deep dark eyes.
Yes.
With you in charge? Cade asked. Ananda smiled slightly.
I meant what I said about Buddhism being democratic. You've been part of the group mind. Is anyone in charge? Is any single neuron in charge in your brain?
Cade nodded to himself. It had felt organic, emergent, self-directed, without any particular center. They were each pieces of the mind that emerged when they meditated. But how committed to that was Ananda? You are in charge, though. Ananda looked at him calmly.
In the perceptions of outsiders, perhaps. But here, I'm the oldest. I have the most experience. My thoughts carry some weight. When our minds are apart, I have certain authority. But when we are connected, the group mind contains me. I'm just one part of it. The decisions it makes are wiser and more just than the ones I can make alone. The insights it can glean and the truths it can reveal are deeper than those I can glimpse alone. I respect that. I am a piece of this, not its master.
Cade nodded to himself again. What you're working towards? Is it just for monks? He asked. Just for meditation?
For anyone who can master it. For any purpose they can put it to.
Anyone? Cade asked. Ananda looked back at him impassively.
Anyone.
But mastering it takes practice, Cade said. It takes effort. Hours of meditation every day, for months, years.
Yes.
So this won't ever be in reach of most people.
It's in reach of them, if they but expend the effort to grasp it.
Cade shook his head. I mean, practically speaking, most people aren't going to meditate for hours each day. Ananda nodded slowly.
True. Most will not be willing to expend the effort.
And if there were a shortcut?
A shortcut, such as the one that you have taken?
Ananda asked. Cade nodded. Something like that? Ananda gazed at him, considering.
How long did it take you to learn to read?
The question surprised Cade. A year or two, I suppose.
And to speak?
Ananda asked. Maybe 2 years, Cade ventured.
Imagine,
Ananda said,
a world where it took most of a lifetime to learn to speak, to learn to read or write, where many never even reached that point.
Cade closed his eyes, trying to picture it.
Imagine that you could show people a faster way,
Ananda continued,
that in a year or two you could show them the basics of language, of literacy.
Cade imagined.
Would you do it?
Ananda asked. Yes, Cade replied.
Even though it would surely be used at times for profanity or vile speech?
Yes.
Even though fools might read dangerous things written by bigger fools, might follow their instructions and hurt themselves or others?
Yes, Cade replied.
Even though writing might be used to describe weapons that could be used to kill others?
Ananda asked. Yes, Cade said.
Even though charismatic fascists might use the power of speech to stir people up, to incite violence, to stoke hatred, to create war?
Cade swallowed. Yes.
Why?
Because I think people would use it for more good than harm.
Is that the only reason?
And because I think it's just good. It's just good for people to be able to communicate more easily. It's just good for people to be smarter, to be more connected, to have access to more of each other's thoughts.
Then you have my answer.
The old monk rose smoothly to his feet and padded silently out of the great hall. Cade sat there alone for long minutes, intensely aware of the weight of the fob on the chain around his neck. Eventually he rose painfully, crutched his way slowly out of the hall, and went to see if anything was left of dinner. 46. Calm before the storm. Becker got the call from Price less than an hour after the meeting ended. The president had approved the plan, with the conditions she had specified.
"Don't screw it up,"
Price told him. Becker hung up and called the Boca Raton with the news. They were in business. In his room, Cade turned off all net connectivity on his slate, then slowly eased the chain over his neck and slid the fob into place. The fob drew power from the slate. It came alive in his mind, opened itself to his nexus, connected him to the slate. A nexus interface card, the one they'd printed for Watts, no doubt. And on the same fob, data storage, a script, the sort of script he'd expected. He lay back and began to copy the Nexus files from his mind to the fob. He made a few small changes along the way, just in case. Satisfied, he pulled it from the slate, hung it around his neck once more, let the slate connect to the net again, and lay down to sleep until Shu arrived. Suyong Shu said goodbye to the final guests at the VIP reception. It was nearly 11 p.m. The conference was ended. The post-conference workshops were ended. The post-workshop final reception was ended. Finally, she could attend to important matters. The black opal rolled into sight. Fang got out, pulled open the door, lifted the umbrella against the night rain. Time to go.
"Stand by for flight operations," came the voice from the bridge.
Nichols watched nervously.
"Flight deck opening," said the bridge. "Flight elevators 1 and 2 engaging."
On the foredeck of the Boca Raton, nearly a third of the length of the hull was retracting, radar and sonar absorbent panels receding into the ship's belly, then sliding slowly and smoothly to the side to reveal the full 40-meter length of the forward combat deck, now configured entirely for flight operations. Slowly, two fully fueled, armed and loaded XH-83 Banshee stealth assault helicopters rose up into view. Each carried a pilot and 6 heavily armed and augmented Navy SEALs. The helicopter's folded-in rotors began to unfold into flight configuration. On the deck, their engine whine would be audible now as their systems warmed up. Fueling hoses decoupled from each chopper with a puff of outgassed steam. Weapons checks completed. Green across the board. Engines green. Stealth green. Electronic warfare green. Nav green. Flight green. The rotors locked into their fully expanded configuration.
"Go for rotor spin-up,"
the bridge voice said. They began to spin, lazily at first, then faster still. Downdraft flattened the seas to either side of the ship.
3 seconds to clamp release. 2, 1.
The deck clamps released the landing gear of the choppers. As one, they rose up and forward into the night sky.
"Banshees away,"
the bridge said.
"CNC, you have the ball."
"Roger that, bridge,"
Jane Kim replied.
"CNC has the ball. CNC out."
In the air, the Banshees began to retract their landing gear. With the landing gear pulled in, the choppers would be nearly invisible to radar. Their chameleon-ware underbellies would make them blend into the dark sky to ground observers. It was midnight. The two choppers would fly low and fast, 5 meters off the surface, make their target around 1 a.m., and be back with Lane and Catarines a little after 2 o'clock.
"End flight operations,"
came from the bridge.
"Elevators 1 and 2 to bays. Stealth hull closure in 3, 2, 1.
The radar and sonar absorbent hull of the great ship began to close over the combat hull once more. Shu reclined in the plush rear seat of the Opal, slate in hand, following up on conversations and business from the conference and post-conference workshops. Sometimes she wondered why she came to these things. They were almost to Ananda's mountain sanctuary, starting the winding trip up the mountain road. She'd been here only once before. Ananda's monks were of great interest to her. The abilities of a properly trained human mind never ceased to amaze her, even now. What they could do if they combined the best of her knowledge and Ananda's training methods. Fang was suddenly alert. Something had caught his interest. Something had buffeted the car slightly, like a burst of wind. He tapped a button on the console, muted the Brahms he had been playing for her.
"What is it?"
she asked. The Confucian fist didn't answer. Instead, he killed the petrol engine, let the car coast on batteries, hit a button to lower the windows.
"He's listening for something,"
she thought. She knew better than to interrupt him at such a moment. She felt for the contents of his thoughts, subtly, so as not to distract him. Fang tapped another key. The windshield became a display, infrared, she read from him.
There, on the display, 2 faint red spots, fainter than a human body, but elevated above the ground, receding away and up, and in Fang's superhuman hearing, the faintest hint of the whoop-whoop-whoop of rotors.
"Helicopters," he said aloud. "Stealth, heading where we are."
Shu felt a chill.
"Could they be Thai?
She knew the answer as she voiced the question. Fang shook his head.
No, Chinese, EU, or American. How long?
She read the answer in Fang's mind. 5 minutes until the choppers reached the monastery on current course and speed, 10 if they slowed over the mountain to come in silently. She opened to her higher self. The light and power of her massive intellect coursed through her. She absorbed all knowledge of American military helicopters. Chinese Ministry of National Defense databases opened to her, showed her the known and suspected positions of all American forces, their capabilities. So, an American ship might possibly be in the Gulf of Thailand.
Step on it, she told Fang. Get us there as quickly as you're able.
Shu pulled out her phone, hit the button to call Ananda. She hoped she was in time. The turbocharged gas engine roared into life as Fang took them from electric cruise into hydrocarbon sprint. The phone pulled Ananda from his meditation just a bit after 1 a.m. It was Shu. Was she here then? He answered.
You have two or more American military helicopters headed towards you. ETA 5 minutes.
The word shook him.
They would come here?
They would. Ananda breathed in with his mind, yelled out the thought of alarm.
Hide the Americans. Prepare for unwanted guests.
He looked at his phone. Dared he make this call? Dared he not? He dialed. A voice answered in Thai, crisp, professional, military.
This is Professor Samdet Prananda,
he said, putting all the dignity and authority of his name and position into his voice.
Get me the Minister of Defense.
190 kilometers away, alarms began to sound at Korat Air Force Base. Ready fighters ignited their engines, raced down the runway, canted their noses up to achieve flight. In moments, two Indian-built IA-9 Rudra NG fighters were in the air, racing southwest towards Saraburi. 30 seconds later, they went supersonic. Time to Saraburi, 8 minutes. 47. Incoming. Cade woke to someone shaking him. Was it Dawn? No. Was Shu here? He opened his eyes. It was Bon, the monk who'd brought him his meals, brought him crutches. There was another monk behind him.
Helicopter,
the young monk said, pointing at the sky.
Helicopter!
What? Cade didn't want to get on any helicopter.
America!
Bon yelled. Oh, no. Oh, fucking no. They found us! His heart was pounding. There was no serenity package running to calm him. Bon and the other monk were trying to lift him out of the bed.
No!
He yelled. They were half-carrying, half-dragging him towards the door of his tiny cell. Cade thrashed.
No!
His ferocity surprised them. He slipped free of their hold and clattered onto the ground. They stared at this crazy American who wouldn't come with them to safety. The slate was on the table, out of his reach. His crutches were by the bed, out of his reach. He tried to lever himself up onto his good leg and collapsed back to the ground in pain.
The slate!
He yelled. He pointed madly at it. Bon grabbed it, pushed it into Cade's hands.
Helicopter!
The young monk yelled, pointing up at the sky. Cade pulled the chain around his neck up over his head with one hand.
Helicopter!
Cade nodded. American helicopter! Bon nodded enthusiastically, tried to take his arm. Cade shook himself free, jammed the data fob into the I.O. slot on the cheap slate. Did he have net signal right now?
Yes.
A window blossomed on the slate, showing the contents of the data fob. He hunted for the script Watts had placed there. Mass distrib. His finger hovered over it. Did he really want to do this? He hadn't done any of the work to make Nexus 5 safe from abuse. Images came to him unbidden. Narong pointing a gun at Ted Prat Nung's head. His will, the ERDs. The Dalai Lama, dead in a pool of his blood, murdered by his subverted friend. Sam's parents, their eyes glazed by communion virus, watching her floggings, sending her off to be beaten and raped. He thought of all the horror stories he'd ever heard about Dwitty. People would abuse this. Monsters would use it for monstrous things. There would be blood on his hands, coercion on his hands, unthinkable terror and pain on his hands. His finger trembled. Bond tugged at his arm, urgently. It was far away, another world. He thought of Watts, of the way Nexus had changed him, of Shu, of her vision of picking and choosing who would make the jump to the post-human condition, of her vision of a post-human elite ruling over the rest of humanity, of Ilya, of her words to him on their call.
Broad dissemination and individual choice turn most technologies into a plus,
If only the elites have access, it's a dystopia.
He thought of what he told Ananda just hours ago. Because I think people would use it for more good than harm, he'd said. And because I think it's just good. Cade's heart pounded in his chest. He was sweating. His whole body was beginning to shake. He could be dead in minutes. Dead or on his way to some deep dark hole he'd never emerge from. Was this how Watts had felt, just before he'd dropped through the ceiling to save them? It was now or never. He stabbed the icon with his trembling finger. God help him. Distribute data fob contents worldwide. Yes, no. Yes. Fucking yes. A progress bar appeared. Connecting. Uploading. 14 minutes remaining. There was no way back. Whatever happened to him now, whether he died or went to jail, at least he'd done something with his life. Cade hoped it was the right thing. He slid the slate under his narrow bed where it would be out of sight and let Bon and the other monk carry him away.
Target in sight, Bruce Williams said. No lights, no movement, all clear on IR and radio.
Nichols nodded.
Commence operation.
Roger that, Williams said. Starting jamming now. Jamming active.
Both Banshees lit up their wideband signal jammers.
Deploying SEALs now, Williams said.
In the cell Cade had fled from, a discarded slate flashed a new message on its screen. Connection lost. No one was there to see it. After a few minutes, the screen dimmed to black. SEAL Sergeant Jim Iverson fast roped silently down the line from Banshee 1. His heads-up display pointed the way to Target 1's cell. His team assembled around him. Together they crept silently, nearly invisible through the complex. Building in sight, west entrance approaching. What was that sound? Then the first dot appeared on his HUD. Three dots, moving away from this building, out the other side, heading away from them. Then more dots, tens more, everywhere. The handle of the door turned, it opened, and monks filed out in their orange robes, bald heads, serene expressions on their faces. Dozens of them, scores of them, hundreds of them. Bells began ringing, like the church bells of his youth. Bright lights came to life around the courtyard where they'd fast roped down.
Oh, fuck.
Nichols watched as teams 1 and 2 dispersed, heading for Lane's cell and the nun's dormitory where Katarones was housed.
Contact, contact, Jane Kim said. I've got shapes moving on IR.
What the hell?
Nichols asked.
More contacts, Williams said. All over the place.
Doors were opening on buildings all over the complex, spilling visible light out into the courtyards. Warm bodies were walking out of all of them, all over the place. And then the bells began ringing. Great bells, monastery bells, ringing and ringing and ringing. Lights came on, floodlights illuminating the courtyard, illuminating the orange-robed monks filing silently and calmly into it, beatific smiles on their faces.
Abort!
Nichols yelled.
Abort, abort, abort! Get them out of there ASAP!
He looked at screen 3. Becker was ashen-faced. The mission was a bust. Jim Iverson's HUD flashed a message from command at him. Abort, abort, abort.
Abort?
There were fucking monks between his squad and the choppers. They were everywhere. He whispered back furiously at command.
Sir, Jane Kim called out. We have Lane on scope. Banshee 1 has a shot on him.
It didn't matter. They had to abort.
Stand down, he told Kim.
Teams 1 and 2 both pinned by monks, Williams said. Still stealth. Lots of bodies between them and the zipline.
Move the line to them,
Nichols ordered. A flash of light lit up one of the screens.
Oh, fuck,
Williams said. Nichols looked over. Faces everywhere. Serene faces. Bald heads. Orange robes. All crowding closer.
What the hell was that?
Photo, Williams said. The monks are taking pictures.
Complete the mission, Becker said from the screen.
What?
Nichols asked.
We're made, his boss said. Too late to change that. Take the shot on Lane. Grab Katarones. Get the hell out.
Nichols was stunned. Complete the mission. But their orders were not to get caught. They were caught already. Complete the mission.
Take the shot, he ordered. Tell Team 2 to proceed towards Blackbird's cell. We're go to finish the mission.
Cade hopped madly along, his arms around Bon and the other monk's shoulders, letting them half carry him. He heard a sound, and the monk to his left fell with a clatter.
Oh, fuck,
Kate almost fell too, Bond barely keeping him upright. They rounded the corner, out of sight from the helicopters, and kept running.
Where are we going?
Cade yelled as he hopped.
Hide!
Bond said.
Stairs!
They turned another corner, and Cade's good leg slipped on a wet cobblestone. His leg went out from under him, and the ground rushed up. Bond tried to grab him, overextended, and they both fell to the hard ground. Cade heard a crack from inside himself, felt fresh pain in his side.
Fuck!
Bond got back on his feet, slowly dragged Cade up as well.
Oh, God, that hurt!
Iverson winced as another flash went off from another camera. He almost missed the message from command. Proceed? Follow the targets. Roger that. The HUD showed Target 1 40 meters to the northwest, but all he could see in that direction was row upon row of bald men in orange robes, hands folded into their sleeves, serene expressions on their faces. They pressed in close around him. He whirled to go around them. More monks blocked his way. He pressed forward. A dozen bodies pressed back. Another two SEALs were behind him. They elbowed and pushed their way through the press. It just reformed around them, pushed back against them. The mass of monks moved like a single organism, shifting and reforming to block them any way they turned. This was fucking insane. Didn't these men know they were armed?
Team 1, you are cleared for non-lethal fire. Disperse that crowd.
Roger that.
Iverson flipped off the safety, fired a trank round into the belly of the monk in front of him. The orange-robed figure slumped to the ground silently. Another monk replaced the one he'd shot immediately, face utterly relaxed. Iverson fired again. A body fell. Again, another body. Again, another one. His squad mates did the same. Monks fell. Other monks moved forwards, even before their comrades' bodies could hit the ground. Monks behind them caught the falling ones, dragged their limp bodies away, took their places. Fucking insane! Sam woke to the sound of bells. Not right. It isn't morning yet. Then she heard Vipata's breathless voice shouting in Thai.
Samantha, we have to hide you. American helicopters are coming.
Oh, fuck. Vipata flew into the room, looked around, grabbed Sam by the hand.
Come with me. I'll take you to the cellar.
She could surrender, hand herself over, plead insanity. No. She wouldn't see another child die because of her. She wouldn't be part of another Bangkok. There had to be a better way. Vipata was yanking at her.
This way, the cellar, we hide.
She'd made a promise to Watts to protect Cade. Sam shook her hand free.
No, Vipata, you hide. I have to fight. Then I fight with you,
the young nun said. There was steel in her voice. Sam stared at her.
She's older than I was when I learned to fight,
Sam thought to herself.
Okay,
she told the girl.
Here's the plan.
Iverson fired and fired and fired. He emptied clip after clip into these orange-robed men. His squad mates did the same. Finally, the press of monks eased. A few stood watching them from windows and doorways. None approached. Target 1 had gone off the scope. Iverson's HUD showed the target's last known position and vector. He broke up his team to cover possible routes, gave himself the direct pursuit. He dashed forward, rounded the corner of the building. He was in a triangular space between the large meditation hall on his right, the monk's quarters on his left, and the rock wall of the mountain ahead. Nothing moved on IR. Wait, there, a sound, a muffled curse. Iverson rushed forward, rounded the corner, saw two figures trying to clamber through an open doorway. He had them.
No sign of Blackbird, sir,
Jane Kim said.
Not in her cell. Team 2 dispersing, searching the area.
Nichols swore softly to himself.
Possible contact,
Kim called out.
Behind the buildings!
There, on one of the Team 2 helmet cams, a woman in the middle of the passage, in nun's robes, facing away from them.
Take her down,
Nichols shouted.
Don't get any closer!
No SEAL was a match for her fourth-generation enhancements. A blur came in from the side of the screen. The camera turned, caught a glimpse of motion, then died, static.
Fuck! It was an ambush!
Sam tightened the knife belt she'd taken from the SEAL around her waist, slung the other belt with the stun grenades and explosives and powered a sender over her shoulder, fastened it across her chest. The assault rifle was biometrically locked to the SEAL, useless to her. She turned to Vipata.
Ready?
She asked. The girl nodded, wide-eyed. Sam interlaced her fingers. Vipata stepped up, and Sam sent her up onto the roof. The girl clambered for a hold, found one. Sam crouched and leapt, pulled herself up next to the girl. It was slick and wet here. Vapata clung to the slippery roof tiles. Sam looked up into the cloudy sky. As she'd hoped, this side of the roof, slanted to face the mountain, was out of view of the choppers. She began to slowly slither forward on her belly towards the peak of the roof. She needed to see what was going on out there. Cade groaned in pain as Bon half-dragged him down the walkway between the meditation hall and the stony mountainside. They reached something, a heavy wooden door. Bon fished out keys while still supporting Cade, wrestled with the lock, opened it. Beyond the door lay a set of stone stairs, heading down into the gloom. Click! Cade heard the shots. Bon went limp, started to collapse forward. Cade tried to grab Bon as he fell, missed. The young monk toppled forward and down the stairs with a hard thud, and another thud, and a sickening crack. Cade turned. There was a large, heavily armored soldier pointing a rifle at him. He had nowhere left to go. He let go of the door jamb, threw himself backwards, hoping he'd survive the fall, find some way to hide down there. The soldier's arm shot out, hauled him back, threw him across the walkway and into the rock wall of the mountain. His head and body collided with the hard rock. Vision faded, stars bloomed, pain racked his midsection, his bad leg folded under him. Cade flipped on Bruce Lee. Targeting circles blossomed in his vision. Attack and defense buttons loomed. Full auto. Click. That target. Click. His good right leg lashed out at the soldier's knee. The big man caught the foot, used it to spin Cade around and onto his stomach. The software brought Cade's hands up to catch him in plank pose, lashed out with the foot again. The soldier's knee came down on the small of Cade's back. Bruce Lee tried a roll and a knife hand strike to the throat of the man behind him. The soldier held him down, fended off Cade's struggles, grabbed the hand and cuffed it. Bruce Lee tried to push his hips up off the ground to create room to twist to the side. The soldier was too heavy. Bruce Lee spotted the knife on the man's belt, reached for it with his free hand, got his hand on the hilt. The soldier's hand came down painfully around Cade's wrist, twisted hard, cuffed it to his other hand. Cade struggled, and the soldier smacked him across the back of the head, bouncing Cade's face off the wet stones of the passage. Cade felt his nose crunch, blood fountaining from it. His vision went gray again, stars spun around him. When his wits returned, he found that his legs were bound. The soldier yelled something into a radio, tossed Cade painfully over his shoulder, and started to jog.
"We've got target one," Bruce Williams exclaimed. "Iverson is headed back to Banshee One. Team falling in around him."
"Excellent," Nichols said. On screen three, Becker smiled thinly. "What about Blackbird?" Nichols asked.
"The rest of Team Two just got there. Man down is hurt but still breathing. No sign of Blackbird."
Nichols frowned.
"Where are you, Sam? Where are you? Don't make us hurt you. And don't hurt too many of us."
Sam froze near the top of the roof. She could hear the team below, searching for her. The wet roof tiles seemed to be shielding her from IR for the moment. Vapata clung to the slick tiles for dear life next to her. She saw Sam look at her and flashed a forced smile. Atta girl. The courtyard was strewn with fallen monks, dozens of them. At least 50-60 monks lay on the cold, wet stones. Two distortions in the sky anchored two ropes that trailed down into the courtyard. There was a Navy SEAL guarding each.
There.
Motion from near the monks' quarters. Four SEALs jogged into view. The one in the middle had someone over his shoulder. Long, lean, wearing boxers and a cast. Cade. They made the rope below the closer of the two choppers, and the SEAL carrying Cade attached his ascender to the rope and zipped back up.
"I could let them take Cade,"
Sam thought.
"No, that was the coward's way."
She scanned the men, at least four, maybe more in the chopper, armed, augmented, American. They did a job a lot like hers. Could she fight them? Yes, if she had to. She waited until four of them had ascended the line, then slid down the wet roof, jumped into the courtyard, rolled and came to her feet in a sprint. The last SEAL had his gun over his shoulder, both hands on his ascender. He hit the button and zipped up, just as he saw her closing on him. There were shouts behind her. The other fire team had come out from the maze and were in the courtyard now, tens of yards back. Trank round struck the ground at her feet. The final SEAL reached the top of the rope on his ascender, climbed into the helicopter where they had Cade. Sam sprinted straight at the rope, slapped the ascender onto it one-handed as she ran by, and jammed her thumb onto the ascend button. The device yanked her up by one arm, even as her momentum swung her out into a wide pendulum arc. She pulled a stun grenade from her stolen belt, felt its cold weight in her palm. A seal reappeared above her, assault rifle pointed in her direction. Sam jerked with her whole body as he fired, perturbed the pendulum swing as his shots ripped through the space she'd just occupied, flung the grenade with all her might. The seal saw her throw, ducked back into the chopper for cover. The stun grenade arced fast and hard through the air, hit the edge of the doorway, exploded with a loud bang just outside the open door of the Banshee. The ascender whined as it zipped her up towards the chopper above.
Sir, we've got Blackbird. She's attacking Banshee 1. She's on the rope, headed up.
Call him back, Becker said from the screen. Get her in Banshee 1. Seal it. Subdue her en route to the Boca Raton.
Nichols nodded.
You heard that, Jane. Tell him to let her on board, then keep her there.
Roger that.
And get Team 2 up on Banshee 2. We've got what we came for.
48. No plan survives. The black opal came over the final rise in time to see the seals disappearing into the stealthed helicopter.
There, he's in that one,
Shu sent to Fang.
And Cataranes is headed there, too.
The woman was dashing towards the chopper Cade was in. Fang gunned the engine for the gates to the compound 100 meters away.